Bulletproof Radio, a state of high performance.
You're listening to Bulletproof Radio with Dave Asprey.
Everyone's talking about red light therapy beds, and for good reason. There's a company called ARRC LED that's building an entirely new class of LED devices. ARRC LED beds integrate proprietary scanning technology and frequency protocols to shape the delivery of six different wavelengths in dose-optimized photobiomodulation. Yes, that's a lot of words. What it is, though, is that photobiomodulation improves the underlying energetics of the cells in your body. And those changes can benefit nearly every tissue and organ and system in your body. You change your cells and you change your life. For more information, visit ARRCLED.com. Hey there, ice bath lovers. Do you want to take your cold exposure game up a notch with some contrast therapy? Well, you should, because cold plunges and contrast therapy can lower stress, up your immunity, and even help you sleep better. It works better than just cold therapy alone. Well, now you can do that with the new Michael Phelps Chili Goat Cold Tubs by Master Spas. Whether you want to relax in a hot soak or get energized with a cold plunge, the Michael Phelps Chili Goat Cold Tub has you covered. You can easily hop out of the hot water, get in the cold water, and go back and forth. When you do that, you get better results in less time, and that's what biohacking is all about. Go to chiligoattubs.com, use promo code DAVE500, and you can save $500 on any Chili Goat cold tub. I have one in my backyard. That's chiligoattubs.com, promo code DAVE500.
Today's cool fact of the day is that it takes up to 200 muscles to take a single step.
Quick question for you. What makes you feel more invigorated, less stressed, and more in control of your body? The answer, more energy. Specifically, more quantum energy, because our bodies are quantum systems. Leela Quantum Tech has figured out a way to harness quantum energy so you can reach a state of vibrancy that you've probably never felt. Dozens of studies show that Leela Q's products neutralize the effects of harmful EMFs around us and even release positive energy that can improve your blood flow, optimize your heart rate, and other benefits. Leela Q has some heavy science backing it up. A recent study looked at people who use Leela Q for just 10 minutes. The study used a special blood illumination technique called dark field microscopy, and it showed significant protective and improvement effects on blood flow. So take a quantum leap into higher vibration at LeelaQ.com/Dave and claim your exclusive 10% discount.
Today, I'm interviewing Glenn Elzinga from Alder Spring Ranch for the second time. Our first podcast with Glenn was podcast number 42, and it generated so much interest that I invited Glenn back on to answer some more questions about grass-fed beef, grass-fed ranching, the color of beef fat, and things like that. We're also doing a live video, so you can actually see what Glenn looks like. And let me tell you, if you're just listening to this, not watching on YouTube, he looks just like a cattle rancher. He's got, you know, the cool mustache, the suspenders, you know, the harness for draft horses on the wall. So this guy's legit, as legitimate as it gets.
And yeah, but Dave, I couldn't cut holes in my cowboy hat, you know, to fit these silly headphone things in. I mean, that's what I should have done, I guess.
That's hilarious.
Just retroed.
So you probably would have been. All your pictures, you're wearing a cowboy hat.
And yeah. So this is a little unusual.
Now, Glenn, I've been eating your beef for like 10 plus years. I must have spent, I don't know how many thousands of dollars on it over the years, because it is. When I lived in the U.S., it was the primary source of beef in my life. I had a whole freezer full of it. You know, you have those carne ranchero cuts and all. And I've sampled several dozen different grass-fed mail-order ranches. And, you know, I invited you on the show and I picked yours because of the color and the texture and the consistency. Mm-hmm. And just, you're obsessive with your animals, man. And that's good. I value that greatly. You can find more info if you're listening to this and you don't know about Alder Spring. Check out bulletproofexec.com/beef. And we've got all the links to Alder Spring there. You'll also find links in the show notes on bulletproofexec.com, either in episode 42 or in today's episode. Glenn, welcome to the show, man.
Thanks a lot. It's good to be back, Dave.
Tell me a little bit about your bio. Like, how did you get started 20 years ago doing grass-fed beef back when people couldn't even spell grass, or if they did, it meant something very different?
You know, we had a long-standing interest in agriculture as a family. My dad actually was a Frisian dairy farmer that came across the pond and immigrated to Canada. As did all my uncles, my grandfather. They brought the whole dairy farming business with them from the Netherlands. And post-war Netherlands was pretty traumatic at that time. Little money, a lot more opportunity in North America, so they moved. And they started it here, and they did very well, and they flourished. So it was with those spotted cattle, we call them. We, out west, we call them magpie cattle because they're black and white, that we started. But unfortunately, I just didn't share their desire to milk cows twice a day and be kind of married to that aspect of dairy cattle. So I kind of removed myself from that, got into another wild land kind of process, and it was forestry, and that brought me out here in the West. And as I worked this forestry position as a forest ecologist here in central Idaho, I started looking at these ranches and realized that this looked like something I wanted to do, especially because of my kind of bovine roots. So one thing led to another. Carol and I bought a small ranch. We've always been interested in good food. We were raised in gardens and with gardens and eating garden food all the time, eating our own produce, eating our own meat. And it seemed natural for us to kind of pursue that. I was always members of co-ops and stuff like that. So I kind of was a food freak in terms of, you know, understanding what organic meant and understanding what sustainable meant and what whole foods were long before they were kind of in vogue. This was back in the 70s and the early 80s. And as a result, you know, our wheels started turning about this whole feedlot agriculture thing we've built, this huge infrastructure in North America where we put these cattle fairly wild country. They're grazing native rangelands, and we put them in these feedlots and feed them corn. And it just didn't seem to add up because I knew that cattle were specially adapted and specially equipped to digest grass and grass protein and process that and provide us with food as a result. So it was natural for us to think that way, even though our neighbors thought we were crazy because we started finishing these cattle on grass, which to me, you know, is intuitive. But for them, they've been so like saturated with this whole attitude of you have to put them on corn, you have to put them on a concentrate feedlot, feed them antibiotics every day. And these sorts of things. And you had to kill them at the age of 16 months. Otherwise, they would get old and tough and chewy. And, we kind of divorced ourselves from that whole mentality and kind of came full circle and kind of looked at what the cows wanted to eat. And that kind of precipitated in us the whole idea of letting the cattle choose their own lifestyle and choose their own foods. And it became kind of a wild cattle pursuit, a pursuit of growing wild cattle in wild landscapes.
So you're basically sort of saying it's not enough to be even grass-fed. You want to be grass-fed and, you know, a little bit picky, or you're not in a grass-fed environment where someone dumps grass in with a tractor. You want to let the cows walk around, maybe break up that crusty algae on the top of the soil, increase the fertility of the land, and eat the grass that's best for them.
No, you're nailing a whole bunch of things there. You're opening quite a proverbial can of worms there because, what's happening with the rage of grass-fed is that a lot of people, humankind is reductionist in nature, especially in our Western civilization. We always like to simplify things, you know, pull things out of the complex and move them into the simple. And as a result, they're applying this to grass-fed as well. And they have these systems called feedlots, and now I see people saying they're 100% grass-fed, and these cattle never leave a feedlot, Dave. They're just getting fed a chopped hay ration, processed forage, and they're calling them grass-fed, and it's completely legit as far as the legality of it. You know, when it comes to USDA's definition, they're totally kosher. You know, they can go online and sell them as grass-fed cattle, and it's totally It's a total parallel to the feedlot process of feeding them corn. And that's the difference.
So The USDA method of grading beef itself, like what are the problems with that that you see given your perspective of, you know, the best tasting and healthiest cows are the ones that walked around and picked the grass they wanted to eat? So what does the USDA system enforce, or what does it do that's different?
They've ignored those things. They've ignored things like flavor and nutrition completely. So they've put everything in a generic box based on ossification, how far the bone development has happened, and fat development. Those two things determine USDA grading.
But without measuring what the fat's made of at all, right?
Nothing. There's no residue or no testing or no nutritional analysis or anything. They'll put nutrition facts on each package of beef that basically are generic nutrition facts as determined by just, pulling apart a feedlot beef and just doing analysis on that. But as far as trying to come up with nutritional benefits and differences on how cattle were raised, it's totally ignorant of all those issues.
So then if you're a consumer and you go to the store and you see a grass-fed steak, what should you look for in it versus, say, a grain-fed steak or versus like a unhealthy grass-fed steak? What are the differences you'll see?
Well, I guess if you're in a supermarket and you see a grass-fed steak, I would say this is what you need to do. Run. You need to run.
From a supermarket grass-fed steak.
Yeah, from a supermarket grass-fed steak. Because there's no reason for the grower of that grass-fed steak to do anything different than the grain-fed guy right next to him is, except feed a chopped hay ration or a chopped alfalfa ration off agricultural ground, off highly cropped ground, just like the corn is. So there's really no difference. There's very little nutritional profile difference between the corn-fed beef and this high-concentrate grass-fed beef next to it.
That's a huge claim. This isn't something I've heard. You're saying that the fatty acid composition of an alfalfa and hay-fed cow from a grass-fed feedlot is going to be similar to a corn-fed cow and dissimilar from, say, one of your cows?
You know, there's probably going to be a little higher omega-3 content.
I have to imagine that.
Yeah, there's a little bit of green forage basis here. But think of what the soil is off that cropped, that crop plantation of alfalfa or crop plantation of Bermuda grass. It's a monoculture, Dave. And this is an interesting little side note. We just came out of the Midwest because we had to deal with our in-laws there and the trying to move their estate out from under them and stuff like that. And one they live in a very high agricultural producing area, and it's all corn and soybeans. Anyway, Dave, I walked into the cornfield there, and I felt this 100 times. You can reach into this beautiful Indiana soil. It's black dirt that's 40 feet thick, okay, and it's it doesn't have a rock the size of a pencil eraser in there. You just can't find any rocks at all. It is just soil. It is just tilth all the way down. Actually, it's not tilth. I wouldn't call it that. It is just tillable soil all the way down. And you can reach your hand into it, and you can crumble it through your fingers, but there's no connectivity in it. It just feels like sand falling through your fingers.
The soil matrix isn't there.
There is no matrix. It doesn't exist. So there's no living organisms in that soil. It is a medium on which to grow corn. And you put your nutrients in there in as additives. It's nitrogen, it's phosphorus, it's Roundup, it's all these things. So that's what, unfortunately, the grass-fed thing is going to become. It's going to become this kind of hydroponic agricultural raising of alfalfa and stuff like Bermuda grass, and it's going to come off a nutrient poor soil where you just add amendments to basically get biomass off. That's what you're going to feed to your cattle. As a result, cattle are one of those, they are one of the epitomes of you are what you eat things. And they're going to inhale this grass. They're going to inhale this processed feed. And it's going to be nutrient poor. And that's why, Dave, you and I were earlier talking about the fat and the fat coloration of our beef, how it's kind of orangish yellow. That's why eventually grass-fed, and it's already happening, is going to become a white fat because there will be no beta carotenes. There will be no phytonutrients in that beef at all. It will no longer be nutrient dense. There may be some omega-3 benefits yet because it's still a green forage as opposed to a white corn forage, But beyond that, very little benefit. And there's a lot more to beef than omega-3s. It's just a highly complex, perfect food. It's a superfood because of its complexity and its nutrient density. And we're going to remove all that in a feedlot agricultural system where we raise, quote, unquote, grass-fed beef.
This is a little scary, but I do see this. I've had grass-fed, grass-finished meat that is really, you can barely tell the difference. I don't get the corn hangover. Like, I'm specifically sensitive to Fusarium, the mold that grows on like 98% of corn, and it bioaccumulates. I feel corn in my joints, and I get more brain fog from it. But I eat the other beef. I don't feel like, I don't know what it's called, a beef high that I get when I eat your stuff, and I always have. And it's a ribeye, especially when you do your... You're insane, like choice cow ribeye. Like, you're the only guy on earth who does this, who like samples a steak from each cow. Says these two cows are the premium, like reserve steaks.
Yes.
If you're having a birthday or something coming up and you've never tried beef like this, it's not even of this planet as far as I can tell. We link to that on bulletproofexec.com/beef. We'll make sure you can find that because it's really important to at least one time taste it and then feel the difference. So you also said something important, and it starts with the soil, goes to the grass, the cow eats the grass, and the nutrients from the soil end up in the meat, and they concentrate very nicely. In fact, cows are essentially vegetable concentration machines.
Exactly.
So green juice versus beef, there's some relationships there. But I'm shopping right now for a farm because my belief is that over the next 20 years – the ability to have, you know, under 100 acre farms that operate and have healthy soil is going to become one of the most precious commodities on earth because you won't be able to buy the truly nutrient dense foods. And once you know how you feel when you get fed right, you don't want to go back. It's like
exactly
having the lights turned down halfway all the time because you're eating, you know, grass fed crap food. That said, I'm really serious about the recommendation for all Bulletproof Diet people: eat grass fed meat, even if it's made with less healthy sources of grass, because it's still going to be better than the toxins that accumulate from corn-fed and grain-fed. It's also better for the environment, but not that much better. So
not that much better.
Yeah. Know your rancher. I mean, like you're here. Yeah. They can see you on YouTube, and you raise, what, 300 head, somewhere around that?
Oh, right now it's close to 400 a year. We do 400 a year of these. So
now... I did some math. Tell me if I'm wrong. I was looking at like the average weight of a cow. I know it varies by species and time of year and all that. But if I ate, I think it was 2 pounds of beef a year personally, that I'd be eating about 0.7 cows a year. Like, how much does a hung carcass weigh on average, like after you've removed the guts and the skin?
Oh, usually we're going around 550 to 6. 550 to 600 pounds, yeah.
Oh, got it. So then my math is backwards on that one. But essentially, if you're eating a pound a day, it'd be 0.7 animals, not 2 pounds a day. That's what it was.
Right.
Okay.
Yes.
So basically, how many acres do you have?
Oh, it depends. If you include all of our grazing land that we run on, it's 70 square miles.
70 square miles, but you're nowhere near the capacity of the land then.
No. Okay. And we won't be. That's not our intent because when we're running these cattle as wild cattle, we basically leave them in charge of what they're going to eat and when they're going to eat it. So they're basically grazing according to how they've adapted to eat at the highest peak, at the highest efficiency of their level. This whole business of... kind of micromanaging cattle and putting food in front of them, you know, in the most obvious sense, it's in a feedlot, but I see people doing it in grass as well. They'll lock them in a paddock and say, okay, cows, you're going to eat all of this and then we'll move you to the new piece. And that's totally wrong thinking to me because you're not maximizing what the cow knows to eat. The cow already knows what to eat way better than we could ever dream of. I mean, we could reductionalize that all as well and say, well, this is what the cow needs to eat. You know, it needs to eat this kind of protein and this degree of protein and this, you know, that's what animal nutritionists do. And I think it's a complete waste of time because the animals already have in them, especially if you're picking genetics that are wild kind of genetics, they already have in them that ability. So it's kind of a no-brainer to just let them pick out what they want to eat and that will maximize them for you.
Now, as a systems thinker, I understand that the vast prairie lands that we once had in the U.S. only worked when they had large herds of buffalo roaming yes. across them, doing exactly what you described.
Yes.
And you're doing it on 70 miles for 500 head. But I was just in Beijing, and like it, I felt like I was in like some kind of sci-fi movie, because every building is, you know, 80 to 100 stories tall, and they're all these yes. beautiful, artful, like amazing architecture, and they're pretty much hermetically sealed. And,
yes.
And then just the sheer population density for something like that. The biggest argument I get about the bulletproof diet isn't like, oh, people lose weight on it. It's unsustainable. It can't be done. So it can't be done at scale because there's too many people on the planet. What do you say to people who say grass-fed beef is, you know, a specialty kind of cult following foodie thing, and that it's not sustainable because it won't feed everyone?
Wow. See, I never think that way because I'm real familiar with the row crop system of agriculture because my in-laws did it. And I used to work there probably 2 months a year. I'd go help with harvest. Now, you're right. And if you just think of the use of the land, but you gotta throw in all the other resources. You got to throw in the chemical use. You got to throw in the fuel use. There's so much petroleum input into those types of agriculture that is not sustainable. That portion of it is not sustainable. When you take the whole accounting into the picture, it's not just the land use. It's the whole accounting of it that makes it equal a wasteful proposition, not to mention the carbon issue.
Yeah.
The carbon issue is just gigantic because that soil in the Midwest, where in, you know, in the corn and soybean belt, is so depleted of carbon that if people wonder, you know, how to fix this, it's not about carbon credits or anything like that. It's about converting those carbon depauperate soils back into permaculture type soils that sequester carbon.
You mean you might want to like compost and like mix the corn stalks back into the soil and weird stuff like
well,
that?
Well, it goes even beyond it. It's about, you know, yeah, whatever. It's about permaculture. It's about reestablishing those native grasslands back on the ground. And because there was so much biota below the soil surface in terms of fungi, in terms of plant roots, in terms of arthropods, and in terms of nematodes. Here's a number for you. It's estimated that it's a very difficult thing to ascertain exact numbers, but I've read anywhere from 2 million to 9 billion, which is the population of the Earth, soil biotic organisms live in a teaspoon of healthy soil. Just a teaspoon of healthy soil has that many organisms in it, and that's a huge range. Say it's 4 billion for our discussion today. And all of those animals sequester carbon. All of those have carbon as their basic structural makeup. And then all the dead biota associated with those living biota also have carbon tied up in them, whether it's plant roots or dead arthropods or whatever. So there's a huge amount of potential carbon sequestration that could occur if only we had permaculture established in terms of grasslands.
So healthy soil, it's not just the plants that do it, it's the microbes. I didn't know that, actually. So the microbes are sequestering carbon. Do they do it more so than the grass itself?
Oh, it's probably more so just because of the sheer biomass of all those. Like here's another thing I picked up the other day just reading about fungi. If you took 1/1000th of an acre, which is basically the size of the interior of your minivan or your SUV, okay? If you took that space and just took the top 6 inches of soil in a space of soil that size, say on our ranch where the soil's very healthy, and took all the fungi hyphae, which are the strands of fungi, through that, and put them end to end, they would encircle the globe. 24,000 miles of hyphae in a 1/1000th acre area that's 6 inches deep. That's how much fungal hyphae is in there. That's not plants. It's not plant roots. That's not plant decaying material. That's just the living fungi that's in that soil.
And then you have to ask yourself, how does that fungi change when we change what's in the soil? And the Roundup has been shown to change the nature of the fungus, so it's still there. It's just a little bit angry.
It does, but you know, with Roundup, inevitably, is all these other chemical amendments like nitrogen, and nitrogen just kills it. And that's why that soil in the Midwest has no crumble. I took a shovel out here, and I do this every now and then, just a few weeks ago with the kids, and we just dig a few holes in the soil and do earthworm count. So we count how many earthworms we come up with in a given shovel full of soil on our home ranch here, which is on 550 acres. And there's always like half a dozen to a dozen earthworms in one little shovel full of soil. But also, when you pull that soil apart, it's all kind of stuck together. It's got all this cohesiveness and crumble to it. And that's the fungal hyphae. There's all kinds of substances in there that are organic substances produced by these microbes, produced by fungi, produced by bacteria that give that soil that crumble, give it porosity to allow rainfall to percolate into it. And they're also creating nutrient availability for the plants, for the grass that our cattle eat. And that's why healthy soils are so important for even us, because as consumers of our bovines, you're just getting a huge nutrient benefit from the soil biota that make those nutrients available to the plant so that our cow, which is, remember, she is what she eats,
yep,
and we eat her, and that's why it's nutrient dense. And that's why I'm concerned about the future of grass-fed beef. It's grim, Dave. It's grim. It's a very bleak picture because corporate megalomania is really going to get a hold of this idea.
Yeah.
And they're going to say, wow, this is a no-brainer. People love and want grass-fed beef, and there is a factory way to raise it. And here's how. We're going to put it in a feedlot. We're going to grow the plants we need on highly managed row cropping systems, and it'll be no different. You know, the nutritional profile will begin to merge very, very, very succinctly with grain-fed beef.
That's a sad thing. It's becoming sort of tough to explain to people, yeah, you want grass-fed, but not just any grass-fed, because there's a certain level of pickiness
exactly
that anyone's going to do. But if you look at wine, right? Mm-hmm. Oh, no, that wine is much better than this wine. And even coffee, like people could tell the difference between my coffee and other coffee.
Yes.
So in chocolate, same thing. Oh, this is single estate Ecuadorian, like it's different.
Yes.
It's worth $9
yes
a bar. So why beef isn't even more of an artisanal product than those, I think, comes about from like the National Cattle Association.
Mm-hmm.
Their marketing is that beef is good food. Screw that noise. Like, my beef is better than your beef. It really right needs to be the
right
message. And in your case, yours is the top beef I've ever had, which is like, if there was a sommelier, like little cup, maybe it's a fork hanging on a chain from your neck instead of a little tasting cup like wine. Like, I'd be the guy wearing that. And I seriously, like, hats off that you've done it. But the fact that you spent 20 years, the fact that you've studied soil and forestry, and that your beef is a system, and that you're starting with earthworms and really soil in order to generate amazing beef is kind of cool. So I want to ask you more about your beef.
Okay.
And by the way, this isn't like a paid ad. You didn't pay to come on the show. I'm interviewing you because, like, just for people
right
listening, I'm sort of really excited about your beef, Glenn. In fact, my birthday.
Yeah, and there, part of the deal too, Dave, yeah, is that, you know, I'm okay with people listening to this podcast and not buying our beef or anything like that. I just want them to know
yeah
the truth about where grass-fed is heading. And it's a bummer, but the bright spot is that there's hope. There's still people you can find who are raising these wild kind of beef in a wild landscape, letting them choose what they're supposed to be eating so that we can maximize the nutritional benefit to us. So, I mean, that's a big deal. You know, people just need to be discerning in sourcing this food. It's just like going to the farmer's market.
Yeah.
You're going to source people who you trust to not be pouring all kinds of amendments, soil amendments on that ground, to be raising like heirloom vegetables and stuff like that, that have the most bang for your buck, that have the most nutrition in their package of that vegetable. So it's the same thing. It's just about being a discerning eater of food.
Most definitely. I did not start out on my biohacking path expecting to be quite the beef connoisseur and everything else. But when I started paying attention to how I felt and,
yes,
and trusting my knowledge of how I felt like I had a video game power up, those little gold coins that give you more power in a video game, every time I would eat your beef. And it was noticeable. In fact, I tell you, my kids are here in part because of your beef. This was the beef I cooked for my wife every single night when we were developing the protocol for the Better Baby book, because I wanted the best beef I could find anywhere. And we restored her fertility using nutrients. And as a matter of fact, it was a very sad day when you limited the number of ribeyes I could buy. In the early days, I could buy 20 ribeyes and a whole bunch of carne ranchero.
You're cleaning us out.
I was. And, you know, 100 pounds of beef would arrive and go into the freezer. Yeah. And you know, every night was like a party. And now, right. like my birthday's coming up in a couple months here. And so, like, I'm already planning ahead to figure out how I can get your beef shipped to my parents' house in the States. I'm not going to resort to meat smuggling. I'll just eat the beef in the U.S. But, like, it's one
of those. No, it's actually illegal, Dave. You can bring it across. You can buy it in the States. Yeah, you're totally good that way. So,
lovely.
Yeah. In fact, people do that. People, you know, there's a bunch of bulletproof folks, you know, live in B.C. and stuff like that. And they drive across the state line and grab it. So.
Okay, and you are allowed to. I'm excited then, because I will definitely be bringing a truckload of it back in.
No more 20 ribeye stuff, though.
Oh, man. It's actually kind of fair because there aren't that many ribeyes in a beef. And I will tell you that if you're listening to this, there's a limit of one or two probably. Yeah, they're pricey, but you spend more than that on drinks on the average Friday night if you're a normal person.
Yeah, darn right.
So try this once. Cook it gently. Don't overcook it because grass-fed meat cooks differently. And you will have a different experience that day. Like there's a feeling you get, like it's a food high. And this is the cleanest source. Now, all right. We just talked about cooking it, but I wanted to ask you some more about what happens to the cows. So let's go back to what happens to the cows, and let's go back to some more cooking recommendations. You told us about how to cook the outside last time, but what do they eat when it snows? Like grass-fed cattle, you're talking about all these bad things if they can't choose their food. Well, in winter, buffalo get real skinny historically.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Cattle
well, we don't see a lot of snow for one thing, because we're in a high desert valley, right? We're surrounded by these 10 and 11,000 foot peaks. They take most of the moisture. We don't see very much in the valley bottom here. So, you know, we might get a storm that's like 8 inches in depth or something like that, but it's probably going to melt within a few days. It's not that it's always balmy here. It's just that it's dry. And even if it's, say, you know, 5, 10, 20 degrees above zero, the sun is bright and it's warm. And that snow actually sublimates. It doesn't melt, but it sublimates into the atmosphere. And we lose our snow fairly quickly. So anyway, those cattle are out there. And we never put them in barns. They're never in a corral or a feedlot. They're out there foraging. And they're still picking up grass all winter long. Okay, but that grass has been almost freeze-dried, because you get this freeze-thaw cycle every day. Some nights it's 20 below zero. The next day it might be 30 degrees above. And as a result, you end up with this freeze kind of thaw, this freeze-drying effect. A lot of our nutrient value on that grass that's on the stump out there, so to speak, gets oxidized. It's gone. Okay, now it's just roughage. Okay, so now we have to supplement them. And what we do is we harvest about 700 tons of hay every year. And we just finished putting it in a stack a few weeks ago. And it's green grass hay. We have a kind of an unfair advantage here in this same high desert climate and these highly mineralized soils, where we can grow a very, very nutrition-dense hay and put it up very quickly, because we don't get much rain. We don't have the humidity that causes huge drying times like on the East Coast and stuff like that. We live in kind of an unfair advantage situation here of able to rapidly dry hay, capture in a bale, and essentially package those nutrients for winter feeding. So that's what we spread out. It's basically the summer grass in a package. We spread it back out in the winter on those same fields that we cut it off of.
And now you're not using silage. You're not fermenting the stuff at all, right?
No fermentation. No, it's just dry hay. Yeah. We dry it down to about 12 to 15% moisture content.
What do you think about silage in wetter areas? Is fermenting hay and then feeding it to ruminants a good idea?
You know, I got mixed emotions about it. I think it's a very efficient converter. They like it. It's already pre-digested according to what happens inside them. because a lot of the bacteria that cause that fermentation process are already in the cow. So it's kind of a precursor to that. But unfortunately, a lot of times you'll get mold associated with the silage thing, and you get the mycotoxin thing going on. That actually takes away from some of the vigor of the critter, and actually pulls weight gains down, pulls health down. You have health issues that way.
But did you just say that when cows eat mycotoxins, they have less vigor?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So everyone listening who thinks I'm going on and on about mycotoxins, here's a guy who watches what they do to animals and knows about it. Like, this is totally legit. I love it. Just the way you described that is cool. That's my concern with silage as well. I was wondering if you had the same one.
Okay. No, I got the same one. But the other part of it is, and I've picked this up, sometimes, occasionally we'll have hay that gets baled a little too green.
Yep.
And it has essentially become silage. And we don't have any white mold in it, but it turns brown like silage does. We call it tobacco hay because when you pop open a bale, it smells a little bit like tobacco. So you don't see like any mold in there, but the hay is brown and it smells very strong. And it's kind of this sweet...
like compost.
Kind of... Yeah. It's a nice smell, Dave. It really is. Anyway, the cattle love it. And we'll feed it to mother cows occasionally, but we won't feed it to these yearlings anymore that we finish for beef. And here's why. Because one time we were, this was about 10 years ago, and Dave, you know, this whole grass-fed beef thing for us has just been a journey, and we continue on the journey. We still tweak things. We still tweak things all the time. We'll think about some, say, hey, what about this? And we can go into that if you want to hear some latest things we're tweaking. But anyway, we fed some of this kind of fermented hay that we call tobacco hay to these finished cattle, sent them off to the stores we had, and right away we got a phone call within like about 2 days after shipping it off to a store, and we ended up buying all that beef back, and we ended up having to eat it because I didn't want to sell it because it had this musty flavor to it.
Got it.
And so you know, somehow metabolically that went through the ruminant pathway in the cow and ended up in the meat. That,
some kind of organic acid or something.
Yeah, something went wrong, you know. And you know, systems are too complex, and I'm not some kind of microbiologist or ruminant biologist, but something went south, and it showed up as a metabolic remnant inside that meat, and we didn't want to do that again. So as a result, we just feed that to mother cows, so there's no possible action that could happen in the beef we produce that way.
So, all right, let's talk a little bit about how you prepare a cow, how you slaughter it. Does it taste different depending on what season you butcher it in?
You know, if you're a super taster, Dave, and maybe you are, there's so few people that are actual super tasters. There was one guy who came. I'm not either. There's one guy who came here. His name's Mark Schatzker. I don't know if you heard. He's from Canada. He's from Toronto. He's an author, and he wrote a book called Steak. It's Steak, One Man's Search for the Best Piece of Beef or something like that. Anyway, he came out here, flew out here, and I took him up on the range and kind of showed him the wild environment we raise these cattle in. And he is a super taster. He's very discriminating. And I could give him a sample of steak A from January and steak D from, you know, July or something like that. And he could pick it up. But he would say, you know, this is not a big deal. This is not a big flavor difference, but there is definitely a minute difference. But I can't pick it up. I've tried them side by side, and I can't pick it up.
I can pick it up in pork. Like, I don't eat winter or spring pork for that reason. And there's other health reasons not to do that. But in cattle, yes. I can't tell. All right, so you slaughter them. Now, okay, I mean, I don't want to get too graphic for our listeners here, but at the same time, how do you humanely kill a cow?
Bullet. Bullet in the head. Yep. And that's the way we've killed everything.
What caliber? Is it a big gun or a little gun?
No, it's just like a little .22 short.
Okay.
Yeah. It comes from above. Okay. Cattle never see it. They're in a blind shoot. Bullet comes from above, right against the head. There's no chance of missing or anything like that. So death is immediate. I'm just not into any other way, into stunning or anything like that.
So. They don't see each other die as well, right?
No, because... This is you're going to think, you know, I'm over the top here, but we send them down with, there's a total of 14 or 15 on the truck that we send to the kill floor. Yep. And, you know, my preference would be to kill them all here, but unfortunately, USDA kind of likes wrenching around with things tweaking our business. And to me, that would be the cleanest situation possible. But anyway, so what we do is we load them all on a truck, take them to the kill floor, and they overnight there, because we load them in a truck. And Dave, you got to remember, these are wild cattle.
Yeah.
Okay. They're used to me. They recognize me. I can walk out in the field and they come to me within a few feet. I can pet some of them. But anybody else, if it was you, they're going to probably be pretty reserved around. They definitely are social animals and they know me, but they also really know each other. So I sent them down there with herd mates. So they're all very comfortable with each other. You know, there's other people processing at this plant that we use as well. It's not a very big one. You know, they're killing maybe 30 or 40 beef a day, as opposed to, you know, a big ConAgra plant. They're killing 400 beef an hour. Okay, 400 beef an hour in those kind of plants. We're killing about 30 or 40 head a day. Anyway, so they're with their cohorts. They're with their social bunk mates, essentially. They've been living with these other guys for a long time. They're comfortable that way. Anyway, at the last minute, they're separated from one of their buddies, put in a blind alley. They're just standing there wondering what's up next, and that's when they die.
So that sounds pretty darn humane. Okay, so then you hang them for how long? So of course, after they're killed, you have to drain the blood. How long does that take? You take the guts out right away, you skin them.
Mm-hmm. Guts come out right away. They hang at basically room temperature for about an hour or two. And then we bring cooling and aging process in. But the cooling happens very, very slowly for the first about 20 hours. And here's why. If you do it too fast, you get a cold shortening thing. It's where the muscles actually lock in the rigor position and shorten even beyond that, and you end up with tough, very chewy meat. So that's a very common problem with a lot of today's abattoirs, is that they cool it down too quickly and the meat ends up being tough, because it gets shortened. So you have to take that first 24 hours very slowly. Like the number that I usually cite to people is do not go below 15 degrees Celsius before 22 hours or say has passed. Once you're past that point, rigors come out, then you're not going to have this issue anymore. It's got to do with ATP and calcium ions in and outside of the muscle fibers and how they translocate. Is very temperature dependent. So it's actually a really complex thing that somebody finally figured out with regard to the muscle fibers and why it was happening. So,
wow. So that's why some of the grass-fed beef I get is tougher than hell. Like it's really, the flavor's okay, but like I'm pretty flexible. I don't like to, I like a good medium rare or rare steak. Yours rare for sure. But you know, you get some of these steaks, they're just not really edible that way unless you really like to chew. Like I'd almost cook a medium rare and make a smoothie out of it, because at least I could get it down, you know?
Yeah, no, that's actually more of a common problem than people think. And we've actually dealt with it. And it's a disaster when it happens, because it means we don't sell. Because like you talked about earlier, I don't know if you talked about it in a podcast or before, pre-show, where, you know, we sample a steak from every beef that we post online. And here we are sampling, this actually happened early in the summer, we were sampling those New Yorks from the beef that we sell online. We had to pull them all. It killed our website for about 2 weeks. And it was a nightmare. I mean, we lost thousands and thousands of dollars on the deal. And it was just because somebody in our cut floor was new, and they rolled our carcasses out in front of a cooling fan in that first 15 hours, and it cooled them off too quickly. That's all it took. It was just about where they were. So, and my other guys knew all about that. It was just this new guy who didn't understand the process. And it was a good thing that he lived several hours away, Dave, because I think I would have shot him.
I can understand that. When you care about your beef, but same thing with the winery guys, you know.
What?
Yeah. You pick my grapes and left them in the sun? I'll kill you, you know.
I know. You know, it's just there's all these moving parts you got to kind of keep track of, keep tabs of. And, you know, that sometimes is a stressor, but you know, you just keep rolling and make it right.
So let's talk more about the aging process, and then I got to ask you a couple of business questions about this. So now you hang the carcass. You'll age for what, 15 to 21 days, if memory serves?
You know, we used to do that, but now we pulled out, and here's why. In these coolers, and every abattoir I have been in, including the huge ones and to the small ones, all have kind of a funky smell in your coolers, all right? And it's something that you just can't get rid of. I mean, you can sanitize all you want. You could spray bleach all over the walls if you wanted to, but you'll never quite get rid of that funkiness. And it's just because of the humidity combined with organic materials in the air and on the floor and in the cracks in the walls, microscopic surfaces I'm talking about, porosity, you know, having these microbes in there, having these organic materials that are decomposing via microbial activity, because you kind of do have a petri dish situation going on there.
That's one of the reasons that grass-fed hung beef, you know, that's aged, tastes that way, right? Because of the microbiological activity on there.
And it's not in the interior to beef, it's the exterior. Anyway, this is what got me really thinking about it, because we pick up a little bit of funk in our fatty ground beef.
Yep.
And it was because exterior, the fat was the exterior part of the beef a lot of times, because it was cover fat. We'd mix it in, and there was just a little bit of funk there. And my wife, Carol, is a super taster, and she could pick it up where I wouldn't be able to pick up anything, but I trust her on it. And anyway, the next thing that was bothering me personally was the rind of a New York. And I don't know if you've looked closely at the rind of a New York, Dave, but it's got two layers of fat there. And I'm a fat guy. I just love fat.
It's all about that yellow fat, man.
It is all about that yellow fat. So anyway, on a New York strip, that layer of fat on the outside of the New York strip, in that two-layer area, the outside one was sometimes fairly inedible because of the funk. It was just kind of repulsive. The New York was great. The interior fat was great. It was awesome with the dry age, but I got funk on the outside. It's been
years, but I had that happen once a long time ago. In fact, I called you after that. I don't know if you remember this. This was, it's probably like 8 years ago. But I called you and said, tell me about your aging, because I prefer unaged beef because of the mycotoxin issue. You get hyphae that penetrate in.
Yes.
And I usually don't feel great after I eat that. But I could eat yours with no effects because whatever, probably the high altitude, like something you were doing in your hanging and your aging created clean, hung, dry-aged beef. But honestly, I think it's safer and probably more economical to not age it, because you don't lose as much of the water weight as well. So your new beef is hung, it's aged for what, a couple days probably, or not?
No,
even at all?
We're doing seven.
Seven,
doing
okay.
Eight now. Because
I'm really excited to hear that.
I want enough time to pull the rigor out, okay? Yeah. So you don't have the toughness issues associated with that. And I needed a little bit to remove excess moisture, because otherwise, you know, if I'm selling beef by the pound, to me it's almost dishonest. If you got all this incorporated and encapsulated moisture, and you're selling a product with moisture in it. So I wanted the excess to be pulled off.
That's like the opposite of the vacuum pack way that they do to get more moisture in it, like for grain-fed beef.
Yeah. No, that was a kind of petri dish thing for me. Yeah. So anyway, we got the seven-day thing. And then this is what we've just tried recently. And this is one of those things I told you about that we've been tweaking. We've added like another 5 days of wet age on the premium steaks. And it was because we did notice a difference in tenderness when we cut back down to the seven. The flavor was awesome, Dave. Yep. It was awesome. But we're thinking we needed a little more enzymatic activity here in a protected environment, you know, without having kind of a petri dish fetid effect of the long wet age, because USDA allows people to wet age for 90 days. 90 days in a hermetically sealed vacuum pack, being fresh, not frozen, fresh. And to us, that was a negative, because there's anaerobic things that are happening inside that package. There's anaerobic degradation, and there's anaerobic toxins being formed. So we weren't into that at all. But we did want to get the enzymatic effect of a little bit more tenderness. And we tried this, and it worked. It worked. So we're pretty happy about that. So the premium steaks, like New York's and ribeyes, we're doing this, where we're just putting them in at about 38 degrees, keeping them for five more days in a wet age environment. The steak's already packaged, so it's protected from any funk or anything like that. So you get the full flavor, and you get a little bit more tenderness. And then we flash freeze it. Yeah.
Okay. Now, you mentioned packaging. Is there BPA in that plastic you put around?
No BPA. No. No,
why did I think you were going to say that? But honestly, we didn't line these questions up ahead of time. I never do that.
Dave, you got to remember, I got seven kids. and the BPA thing just freaks me out. Okay, you know, you can take me to the man boobs thing on one end, but all the way to the estrogen effects, you know, in utero and for little kids and stuff like that, and sexual dysfunction, you know, and predisposition to cancers and all these autoimmune issues with estrogen. The problem with those kind of mimics is we really don't know the full implications. It was just like DDT. You know, Rachel Carson writes a Silent Spring thing. You know, we know DDT is probably bad because these animals are not able to lay sound eggs anymore and they're breaking, you know. But now we're just beginning to figure out the full implication of what that meant, you know, to the entire plethora of insect life and bird life and animal life out there and what that did. And I think, you know, stuff like BPA is just, it's just the tip of the iceberg, you know, just knowing that this may be an estrogen mimic is just the tip of the iceberg for us. And there's just so much more depth there and implications for health and probably the next generation's health that we have yet to understand. And it's just not worth messing with those things, right?
I got to spend a weekend hanging out with a Carnegie Mellon professor named Pete Myers, who kind of blew the lid off the BPA science.
And, oh, yeah.
I mean, there's heavy-duty reasons to avoid it. So I'm thankful that you didn't cut a corner on your packaging, but it's not how you do things. You're not a corner-cutting kind of guy. All right, so a couple questions for you. If I wanted to buy 100 acres in that amazing valley or something like it in your part of the world, and mm-hmm. I wanted to raise enough cattle for my family and have my internet business running out of that place, what's the cost per acre for good quality grassland like you're sitting on there?
Oh, on an irrigated ground, you know, where there's some way to get additional water on the ground and enhance the productivity beyond the desert environment that we're in. It's anywhere between $3,000 and $6,000 an acre, just depending on productivity.
Okay. So $6,000 an acre, right?
Mm-hmm.
So yep. it's not cheap. I mean, it's valued pretty highly right now. So yes. If you wanted 100 acres, you're looking at, you know, $6 million, right?
Yeah, I mean it's a lot of money. So
and so I mean that's like what a medium sized house. 600,000. I'd add a zero.
Yeah, you added zero.
Oh, well, shoot. Then, okay. The postage stamp house I used to live in the Bay Area, literally postage stamp, like 1,400 square feet on a little lot. Mm-hmm. I think last I looked online, it sold for like $1.3 million. Okay.
Yeah.
So, like, you got to think about this. There's lots of people leaving cities right now because work is mobile. My whole team works all over the place. And so basically, the land that you have around you is one of the most undervalued assets in the entire country right now.
Because, it really is.
Yeah.
It really is.
It is. Yes. And I'm keenly aware of that. So like I'm actively shopping for my own farm out here on Vancouver Island to, you know, figure out, I want my kids to grow up with healthy soil around the house, and I want the animals that we eat to come there. And what if, you know, I was actually part of the system of the environment around my house. I'm working actively on making that a reality.
Awesome.
But let's say I still live in New York or I live somewhere else. Have you thought of just like selling shares of Alder Spring, where literally, okay, I want 1/100 or 1,000th of what comes out of there every year, and like literally running it as a private farm where you don't have to do any marketing online. There's no markup or anything like that. Like the annual membership fee is X amount of money, because I mean, I know how much it costs to pay a farmer around here to run a farm with a couple of pigs, a couple of cows, and to do it on a smaller scale. But is there a business to be had for people with your level of integrity and attention, literally having a subscription-only kind of business where you guarantee what comes out, and if only X amount comes out, they get less. If extra comes out, you sell it and share it.
Basically a CSA. In terms of ranching,
a single ranch CSA only for beef. Is anyone doing that?
You know, there's some people kind of tinkering with the idea. We actually thought about it. We thought about it long and hard. I actually talked to an accountant and kind of ran through all this stuff. But my problem is, Dave, I'm just too darn independent.
Yeah.
You know, because I now here I'd be yoked with, say, you know, 100 or 200 people, 100 or 200 families. I'd be owing them. And, you know, we're going to keep going on this. This is a family enterprise. I'm hoping my kids take it over and stuff so that, you know, the longevity of Alder Spring is pretty secure that way. But on the other side, you know, I owe the bank money and stuff like that. And that's enough for me. I mean, owing people money is not my favorite thing to do. And owing people even a product would be just kind of, I'd have to be real careful about doing that because, you know, I don't want to disappoint people. I want to just keep the free market kind of enterprise part of it going. We have thought about doing simplifying that, and there's a way to do that in our current shop site software to where people could subscribe just like they would to a magazine, and they'd say, you know, hey, like I got this one guy in Brooklyn every week like clockwork, he buys 6 pounds of fatty ground beef.
Lovely.
Because we got this fatty ground beef.
It's so good.
he buys one brisket, so it's a full fat brisket. I think he actually found me on you. He found me through Bulletproof. And let's see what else. He gets one chuck roast. So he gets that every week, Dave. So, you know, I'm like, put together these subscription packages because, you know, people are busy. You know, this guy commutes. I talked to him. One day I called him up and he's in the subway. I didn't know you could get self-service in subway, but he's on a train. Maybe it was the elevated part of the subway. But anyway, he's heading down to work down in Midtown Manhattan, you know, and we chatted for a while, had a great visit, but he don't have time. He don't have time. He don't even have time to really sit on his iPhone, give a credit card number each time. So if I could just retain that information and he could just click on a subscription and tweak it, you know, and say, hey, you know, for the winter, I'd like to have an additional chuck roast and let's drop the steaks type thing, you know, and just tweak his subscription that way. That way it's just going to be easier. It's nice for me because I know that for the most, these people can cancel at any time, but for the most part, they're going to be the real deal. We're kind of doing something like that similar right now with Ace and Quarters. It's not really a subscription thing, but we really, really, that has really taken off. And I think it's just the economy. People are buying Ace and Quarters like crazy. Like I posted some last night, Dave, and I sold 16 Ace and Quarter since midnight.
Wow.
Last night.
I think after the show goes live, you're gonna move a few more. I bought half of your daughter's like prize winning cow a few years back.
All right.
Yeah, and it fit in the freezer, and man, that was a good cow.
Yeah, and so you know, people love that because they're like, I love this ranch and I love what they're doing. And I love their beef most of all, and it's good for my family. I only get to be there every 4 months and buy one of these things. So, so if that works, I know the subscription thing is kind of a no-brainer.
Yeah, it may be time to do that, or even, you know, let me pay 10% more to set aside something when it comes out.
Sure.
So when, you know, the ribeyes are there, instead of having to log in and check, I think
they're
you
coming.
Might,
yep.
Can't wait. well, awesome. We're out of time, Glenn. And
bummer.
And I've had a great time as always. I learned something about beef from you. And there's a question I ask everyone. I've already asked you this one time, but maybe you have a different answer this time. What are the top three things that you'd recommend for people who want to perform better? Just based on everything you know from your life, it doesn't have to be beef or anything else like that. Just
sure.
Top three recommendations for people who want to kick more ass.
Oh, you know, we're putting our garden by right now. And that means putting it up for the winter. We're storing stuff, canning beans, canning peaches and stuff like that. And one thing that I've really enjoyed over the summer is going out there and picking some fresh stuff and just working in it every morning around 6:30 in the morning or something like that. And Dave, I get a little dirty and my food that I'm eating is dirty. And there's this huge connectivity between the soil and my gut. I did you know that a lot of the bacteria and the organisms that are in the soil are the same ones that are in our gut? They're identical. Yeah. You know, so basically I'm inoculating myself whenever I get dirty in my garden. So I guess that would be one thing. Get dirty in your garden or a garden, a CSA. Get involved with the soil. Because, I mean, it's not only therapeutic for your health, for your wellness, but it's also this great stress relief. I mean, it just kind of connects you with the land. With that, I would say get off the process. Get off the processed food thing. I mean, we in the 21st century are addicts to processed food. And it's not like we're eating ramen and macaroni and cheese. It's eating even lightly processed foods. We need to get back to our whole food roots and get back to our ancient food roots. Because even, you know, even something like sweet corn is not a real food. In my mind, we grow some of it because we enjoy it. My wife's from the Midwest, heck. But, you know, as a staple, those kind of foods aren't real foods anymore. The ancient food that they came from is a real food. But these things are so nutritionally depauperate, and they're actually a downer for our bodies, that we need to stay away from those things and go back to those ancient foods. And the third thing, I'm 51 now, that really comes to mind, and this has really come to mind because this estate thing we just dealt with Carol's folks in the Midwest, and the complexity of their life was enormous. And these people were in their 80s, and there were so many difficulties, so many tax ramifications and real estate ramifications, and so many things in that house that they did not need. And so I guess in one word, point number three for me would be to simplify. And we need to simplify even before you reach those late years of your life. I'm 51 right now, and it really brought home to me that I need to simplify. I need to get rid of the junk in my life, whether it's material or commitments, and simplify and just focus on the quality things like relationships that have longevity beyond my life. And we just need to get stuff out of our life, excess stuff especially.
Oh, what an awesome list. Glenn, thanks a ton. If you enjoyed this podcast, you can learn more about Glenn's amazing beef by going to bulletproofexec.com/beef. And we'll get you all the links. We'll hook you up with Glenn's ranch. And I seriously encourage you to once in your life try one of his ribeyes. And I'm going to regret this because there won't be any left for my birthday. And while you're at it, throw some of that fatty ground in there because
ground is awesome.
It's an orgasmic experience, to be perfectly honest. So it's worth a try. And if you're going to cook it, get some pastured, really good quality bacon and put a little on that fatty ground just to, round out the flavor. That's how to do it. Glenn, I look forward to having you on again sometime. This has been a blast, just like last time. Thanks. And everyone, go to bulletproofexec.com. Check out this podcast and all the others, and have a great day.
Thank you very much, Dave.
The Human Upgrade, formerly Bulletproof Radio, was created and is hosted by Dave Asprey. The information contained in this podcast is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended for the purposes of diagnosing, treating, curing, or preventing any disease. Before using any products referenced on the podcast, consult with your healthcare provider, carefully read all labels, and heed all directions and cautions that accompany the products. Information found or received through the podcast should not be used in place of a consultation or advice from a healthcare provider. If you suspect you have a medical problem or should you have any healthcare questions, please promptly call or see your healthcare provider. This podcast, including Dave Asprey and the producers, disclaim responsibility for any possible adverse effects from the use of information contained herein. Opinions of guests are their own, and this podcast does not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests. This podcast does not make any representations or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. This podcast may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products or services. Individuals on this podcast may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to herein. This podcast is owned by Bulletproof Media.